Okay, morning all. Well done for getting here, apparently. Look at all the snow. It's fun. Home in Sussex is about 4 or 5 inches. It's friends texting me going, don't go to work. All my friends are 8, apparently. So we're on pages 69 and 70, and we're talking about securities regulation, and we're going to start in with the policies underpinning the EC Securities Directive. So this is heading 3 on page 70. Let's remind ourselves how all this works. The EC directives create the framework principles. So that's what we're going to focus on the first thing this morning, some of those key recitals from some of these EC directives. Then the Commission, in its technical regulations, provides all the detail. And so when you look at the FSA website, and you look in particular at the prospectus rules, the disclosure and transparency rules, and the listing rules, so-called, that's basically putting into effect in UK law the detail of those Commission technical regulations which expand on the directives. Okay, so what we're focusing on is all of this UK implementation of these provisions. Okay, all that's up on the document camera, I'll come to that in a second, is bits of the UK legislation, but that will be for a while. Let's put some more lights on. People sprinting. That's not a good thing. So our focus is going to be then on the UK implementation, which is done by powers being given to the FSA in FSMA and some of the key central principles set out in FSMA, and then the FSA implementing them and the FSA regulations themselves. Okay? So on page 70, policies underpinning the EC Securities Directives, we finished off yesterday, if you recall, looking at the beginning of the Transparency Obligations Directive and its focus on the creation of a single market, which you'll have discussed in EU law, I am sure, one of Kenneth Armstrong's favourite things, the use of securities markets to foster growth, how that's going to help the whole of the European economy, how it's going to foster job creation, you know, and the irony is we look at the recession we're in currently. So there's a point to be made there about, you know, whether or not any of this has actually worked. This was one particular economic theory from the Clinton miracle in the US and onwards, which it was hoped we could replicate across the European Union. So query, is it actually working? It's all right. I'm glad you're here. Begin with the Consolidation Admissions and Reporting Directive under 3.1, or CARD as it's known for short. This deals with listing. As we said yesterday, this is primarily to do with listed securities, which are those largest public companies, okay, traded on the key stock exchange, all the names that we've heard of. And those of you doing company law, one of the key decisions for company management is, at the first level, do you want to be a private company, do you want to be a public company? Being a public company imposes all sorts of different company law requirements on you, securities regulation requirements, as we'll see. But it means that the public are able to buy and sell your shares, as opposed to being a private company, which is preferable typically family companies, for example, because you can retain control by the very fact that the public can't buy your shares. It's much easier to protect yourself against takeovers and those kind of things. Look at Cadbury, for example, at the minute. US company Kraft is determinedly trying to take it over, and Cadbury is now offering itself to anybody else in the world except Kraft, because they just don't want to be owned by Kraft and become part of a huge conglomerate. They want to be part of a very different kind of conglomerate, apparently. And they're claiming, it's fun when you hear things on the radio, like Cadbury are saying that a valuation of them of £10 billion just isn't enough. And you think, well, £10 billion, anything sounds like a lot. But anyway, you know what they mean. So there's that kind of problem anyway. So there's a commercial decision about whether or not you want to be a listed security, whether you want to go through all this. Typically, I think some of the largest companies feel they should, because that's what big public companies do. The difficulty is the cost of compliance with all this regulation. Anyway, what's CARD seeking to achieve? Well, it deals with listing, consolidates a number of earlier directives, and the second bullet point is aims the coordination. The coordination should first be limited to the establishment of minimum conditions. This is recital 6. So we haven't in Cards decided that we're going to harmonise our laws in the sense of making them all the same. Instead, it's a much more limited programme. All the things you discussed when we looked at regulation back in early October, the failure to kind of kickstart organically a pan-European securities market has meant that we've just reined in our ambitions. So we want to set minimum conditions. And as I said yesterday, this leaves it open then to individual member states to set their own conditions that are more stringent than the European standard, so-called gold plating. And therefore we should have, next bullet point, a closer alignment of national regulatory rules. Yeah, coordinating, aligning, this is not making everything the same. So there's something there about just downgrading what we think we can achieve. Coordinating the various national rules and regulations without necessarily making them completely uniform is, you know, acknowledged in Recital 9. I think another problem that comes out of this is that all we've decided to go for now is passporting. The idea that you get, as we said yesterday, if you get approval in one jurisdiction, if you're authorised to have your shares admitted to the official list in one jurisdiction, then that provides you with a passport to have the same done across the European Union in each member state. One kind of real-world problem, which has come out, I mentioned yesterday, Greece, and a remarkable speech in Greece by their president, prime minister, God, I meant to look that up, admitting that there is a large amount of endemic corruption in the Greek establishment. No, no, we can hardly talk the way MPs have been behaving in recent years here, with their expenses and so on and so forth. But this whole thing is built on the idea that if you get your authorisation in one member state, that entitles you to be treated in exactly the same way in every member state. But once we start to worry about whether or not individual member states are doing this properly, whether they're behaving appropriately, whether you are being held to the same standard in every member state, this whole idea about passporting and about having a single market starts to crumble. And this is the complaint a lot of jurisdictions were having recently, of course, when we were admitting new member states, you know, as the EU has spread out eastward. And ironically, of course, there's a lot of the member states already at the heart of Europe that were having these same problems anyway, things they were accusing other member states of. So that's a real problem. I did have dinner a while ago with the head of the FSA in Malta. And I think a lot of people wondered about Malta, very small member state in the European Union now, of course, for most people just thought of as a holiday destination. And they're determinedly trying to develop their financial services business. I was very impressed by Maltese professionals, actually. Maltese students on the LLM program here usually are brilliant. They're incredibly well schooled. I've lectured at Malta, and the stuff they know is quite scary. They read things. It's remarkable. Their great concern, or his great concern, Professor Bannister, was that he didn't want people to treat Malta as some kind of offshore jurisdiction inside the EU. And I think there were a lot of people that probably hoped that's what they could use Malta for. So they're being incredibly careful, you know, and behaving to the letter with how they're implementing regulation, precisely to stop that. So all of this does depend on, you know, how well each member state's regulatory body actually implements all of this stuff. It's going to become part of the key debate we're going to have again later on about banking regulation at the end of the course. You know, the FSA has got gold-plated rules. You know, we've made our regulation, our rule book, more stringent. But in a number of contexts, of course, the FSA has been criticised for just not regulating stringently enough in practice. And so there's a big question there about theory and practice. Argentina, during the period when it disappeared hundreds of thousands of Argentinian citizens, had a perfect constitution. The human rights statutes in Argentina were remarkable. They're an absolute model. And not just of the ordinary human rights, but of economic rights, social rights. It was an absolute model. But at the same time, in practice, people were just being kidnapped by, you know, secret police squads and quite disappeared. So there's always a difference between what's in the regulatory rule book and how it's actually practiced. So that's a real problem for Europe. And I think the Greek example recently just kind of puts that into perspective, actually. Anyway, the whole theory is built on everybody acting the same and everyone obeying the rules. So passporting is the theory. Yeah, you get a license in one jurisdiction that carries across all jurisdictions. The other idea behind that is that, as I said yesterday, we're going to provide lots of information. of prescribed kinds. We'll look at a lot of that in detail when we come back in January. We'll grind through bits of the regulations, show you what's there. But that's meant to be the investor protection, is that the information is provided and then you make up your own mind. It is a market. Remember, one of the FSA's statutory obligations is education. And this is why. You know, once you've left it as a market-based system, we give you information, good luck. Here's a map, off you go. You know, the FSA then, having a role about education, becomes all the more important. And if there are going to be some regulatory bodies that aren't doing their job properly, if things aren't going to be regulated properly, then are we actually protecting those investors? Are people going to be reluctant now to invest in securities markets, having watched what's happened recently, you know, in financial markets in the last couple of years? So it's all built in a circle. And with all these things, it's all built on reputation, confidence and everything else. So that's CARD, relating specifically to listing. The new entry in all this is the Prospectus Directive. And this now is at the heart of all this stuff, 2004. So we moved away from an idea where we distinguish between securities which are listed and securities which are unlisted and have different regulations for each. The basic idea being, if you weren't part of the official list, you had a lower set of requirements. Instead, the Prospectus Directive says, in any circumstances, we said yesterday, where you're making an offer to the public or where you want your securities traded on a quite regulated market, then you must produce a prospectus in the prescribed form. So the idea behind the Prospectus Directive is to make this as broadly applicable as possible to a huge number of securities issues which previously hadn't been covered by the regulatory net. So it's a deliberate policy to widen the net. So recital 4, first bullet point, 3.2.1 on page 17. There's an overarching policy objective of creating a single internal market again. So this is all part of this drive, Lamfalussy and everything else. We want a single market for securities in the European Union. That's what Lamfalussy started out with. It's been broadened to financial services generally from being just securities since. But it's all to do with securities to start with. Our favourite metaphor is to facilitate the creation of Europe-wide securities market with deep liquid pools of capital. Yes. Fabulous idea. So it's all about deep liquid pools of capital again. We're trying to broaden the investor base. Instead of just relying on bank debt, suddenly we've got the likes of you and I, ordinary human beings, thinking, what do we do with all that spare cash we've got? Yeah. Irony. And then we encourage people to say, well, invest your spare cash in the markets. So this is borrowing very much from a US idea of ordinary people investing. Yeah, in a way that we just haven't done in the traditional continental European model. So the Prospectus Directive, third bullet point, is an instrument essential to the achievement of the internal market as part of the Risk Capital Action Plan. The EU constantly coming out with these very grand proposals. The Risk Capital Action Plan. Trouser underpants tortoise. I mean, you're just random words strung together, aren't they? But it's an instrument essential to the achievement of the internal market. So this is one of these policy goals that's pushing towards having a single European market, as we said before. So recital 4, again, the plan is that there's a single passport for each issue of securities, meaning once you get authorisation from what's known as the competent authority in each member state, that's the FSA here, as soon as you get authorisation from that competent authority in one member state, you have effectively a passport then to offer your securities to the public or seek admission to regulated markets across the European Union. Which is why it would be a problem if there were regulatory bodies that were being far more lax in practice in how they gave authorisations in one jurisdiction, because we'd expect lots of people to start heading there to get their stuff authorised without needing to go through all the compliance. Because we're going to see, part of the compliance problem is producing these prospectuses, which are big, fat documents. And they require lawyers, they require bankers, they require accountants, they require other kinds of professionals as well. For example, you're a mining company, you'll need lots of mining experts, geologists and so on and so forth, to attest to the quality of the stuff that's in your mines, engineers to tell you about your equipment. It's very, very expensive to pay all these people's fees to put these fat documents together and produce all the stuff that goes in them. Which is why people would like, in a perfect world, lower regulatory requirements, they would like it if one member state's regulatory authority was prepared to accept lesser compliance. That would be brilliant, because all of this would suddenly become cheaper. Bad for investors if we're not making sure this information is being provided, and it's not being provided properly. So that's the battle that's going on in the background. And whenever we get into public debate about regulation, securities regulation, that's what's meant by cost. So in the financial press, you'll keep seeing people moaning about the cost of regulatory compliance. It's because it requires all of these people and all of these fees, all of these professionals to produce this documentation. So the so-called country of origin principle in recital 14, I beg your pardon. Ordinarily, it's the home state regulator that assumes control. Yes. So if you're a company incorporated in this jurisdiction, we'd expect it would be the FSA as the home state regulator that would be the principal regulator. Although you can instead decide you want to start having your issue done in Malta, done in France, at which point there's then a regulatory possibility for that regulator to become the host regulator instead. So the idea is there's a presumption that wherever your home is for your organisation, that will be the regulator. Difficult, of course, if you are genuinely a multinational organisation, if it's difficult to know actually where you are resident. But, of course, we want to make this a single market, so by making it a market, we want to equalise the ability for you to be regulated wherever you want to be.
Can you actually go and be regulated?
I didn't hear, sorry.
You actually go to some other state and ask for regulation.
So that's the other thing you can do, is to seek to have your issue begun in another jurisdiction, yes. Hence the importance of having minimum requirements. And that's why it's difficult for the FSA, if it wants to gold-plate its regulations here. The risk is people will say, well, why on earth are we going to list in London? Let's set up a subsidiary in Paris and do it there instead.
Can we just remove the authority from the REITs to regulate themselves, so perhaps the companies could be regulated?
I mean, that would require renegotiating everything completely. I know what you mean. This is all built on each member state supposedly having its own regulator. I'm not aware that anyone's directly criticised the Greek financial regulatory system, but their own prime minister has said, we've got endemic corruption in this country, this is why our economy is shot. It's a remarkable thing for a premier to say in a public place. There's a lot of that in the financial press this week. If you Google, Greece and corruption or something horrible like that, you'll find the text of this speech. Yeah, scary stuff. And what's important for our purposes is just, it gives the light to the whole theory is that everyone's going to behave and play the game. excuse me. Recital 27, the issuer bears an ongoing disclosure obligation to make reliable information available to the investing public throughout the life of the security. This is going to be one of the key things we're going to see. Prospectus regulation is primarily focused on providing all the necessary information, which we'll talk about in a bit, up front at the beginning. But there are also continuing obligations to keep providing information throughout the security's life. So while those shares are an issue, for example, you've got to keep making information public about, for example, your financial position, financial statements, producers will see every 6 months, sometimes quarterly, depending on the regulations. So you can't just leave it as one shot for that document. You've got to keep updating it, as we'll see as we go along. Transparency regulations, we'll see in a bit as well, requires the provision of information about who actually controls the company, regardless of who the shareholders are, who's behind the shareholders, who owns any organisation that holds shares. All this kind of information has to be provided on an ongoing basis. In relation to the listing rules as well, there are even more stringent requirements for the publication of information on an ongoing basis. As I said yesterday, the use of recognised information services to transmit things out to the market. So you have companies issuing profit warnings. There have been a lot of this over the last couple of years. As the recession was starting, companies are obliged to issue information about significant changes in their financial status and their business and everything else. And so that's why this stuff is always in the financial press, because those big companies are required to make it public. So an ongoing disclosure obligation is a key part of this. This is the information flow. Yes, it's information in the prospectus and then an ongoing information flow. But it's a marketplace, so the theory is, it's the old theory of markets. As long as there's perfect information, then it'll be a perfectly functioning market, is the theory. Keep providing people information and then let them take the risks themselves. Recycle 30 tells us that jurisdictional differences should be eliminated by harmonising the rules to achieve an adequate degree of equivalence of the safeguards for investor protection by provision of information. And we see here again two things. Investor protection is going to come out of information. If you know things, you're protected. That big truck's going to kill you, apparently protects you against the truck. Yeah, that's basically what we're saying. That's basically what it is, you know. That person's going to shoot you. Oh, brilliant, I'm protected, thank you. Brains over wall. Also, the harmonisation, which started out as an idea of making everybody the same across Europe, in fact, is just an adequate degree of equivalence of safeguards. An adequate degree of equivalence. Will we have the same meal? Well, let's have meals of an adequate degree of equivalence. This is kind of a fantastic Eurospeak again. It really is downplaying again. We're not going to make everyone the same. We're going to generate minimum standards. Okay. And it's difficult to it's easy to criticise European language. It is, of course, translated into a number of different languages, to be fair. So it all tends to be quite bland, and you have to try and avoid using words that mean anything particular in German or anything particular in English. You don't want accidentally to stick the word consideration in and suddenly have English contract lawyers thinking, oh, well, that means something special here. So I mustn't slag it off too much, it's me, but I can't help it. The Recital 41 gives us some central principles of the Prospectus Directive. These are the policy ideas in the background. So if you want commentary, I suppose one of the things you can play with if you're answering problem questions, even let alone if you were writing essays, would be to pick out whether or not you think the regulations achieve these things. Notice they're all stated in terms of need. You know, the European economy needs these things. Yes? Like you need a gingerbread latte or whatever, you know, need. The need to ensure confidence in financial markets among small investors. Yeah. So we're trying to get, you know, members of the public, small organisations to invest. We don't just want it to be pension funds and big financial institutions. We want small investors. So we have to ensure their confidence. Not having a worldwide recession would be a good start. Secondly, the need to provide investors with a wide range of competing investment opportunities. So if you remember, this is a big part of MiFID as well, trying to equalise all those various securities markets. So we don't just need it to be formal exchanges, we also want competition between the so-called systematic internalisers, the multilateral trading platforms, you know, NASDAQ, these kind of online markets, as well as the old-fashioned style stock exchanges. And a level of disclosure and protection tailored to their circumstances. So again, the idea of MiFID, if you recall, was to try and put the onus in establishing conduct of business procedures on the financial institutions themselves. Yeah, instead of telling you what you must do, we give you an obligation to figure out what you have to do to act in the best interest of your customer, it's your best execution, everything else. It's all part of the same idea. We're now tailoring our disclosure and protection requirements to the context. So when we get into the detail of the prospectus regulations, we'll see that the way they function is basically, a pizza is the only decent analogy I can come up with, sorry. There's a base level of things we're going to have to provide in any prospectus. But the prospectus is of different types, for different types of security. So ordinary shares, different from bonds, different from convertibles, different from securitized derivatives, and all these other things that we'll look at in detail in January. Basically, you've got different toppings depending on a different complication of topping, depending on the type of security you're talking about. Okay? Hence, me using the pizza analogy. It's the only one I could come up with, sorry. If anyone has a better one, then I'd be delighted. So, in terms of tailoring these things, we're going to see the regulations are built on. Here's what you've got to have in any prospectus, and here's the things you've got to do for any particular type of prospectus. And pretty much all the prospectus regulations do, even in their detail, is to tell you the types of things you've got to discuss and disclose. It doesn't tell you the precise language to use. which puts all the onus back on the legal advisors, the investment bankers, the accountants, the management consultants, the PR people. A lot of prospectus putting together these days has a big eye to PR as well. How are we pitching this company in the world? How will this prospectus hurt our brand? You know, how much do we divulge in the prospectus if we don't want to get out there into the public? You know, coffee companies don't want you to know that caffeine is addictive. And that's a big thing of what they do in manufacturing coffee, is they want to make sure it's addictive, because they want you to think coffee when you wake up in the morning. They don't like to say this in their advertising, you know. Nescafe will get you hooked, you know. That's not what they want to say. Better than crack. Kenko. allergic reaction. Kenko cane. You know, this is what they're trying not to say. So all these kind of things, you know, there's a lot of PR, oddly, gets involved in putting these things together. But there's an art in that. You're just told the sorts of things you have to disclose, but then you have to work out how exactly you're going to phrase it, what exact information you're going to make public. And that's why there's huge scope there for negligent misstatements and those kind of claims. So this idea of things being tailored, it's bespoke tailoring. Don't die yet. There's hours left of term. Third, there's the need to ensure that independent regulatory authorities enforce the rules consistently, especially as regards the fight against white-collar crime. Yes. Consistency we've mentioned. Yes, if you've got one or two member states whose regulatory authorities aren't playing the game, then you aren't going to have an effective single market. The whole theory of markets is level playing fields and other metaphors to do with equilibrium. Yeah, it's got to be the same everywhere is the idea. So we've got to ensure this consistency. And that's why CESA and those kind of bodies are important, the Committee of European Securities Regulators, is to have that kind of coordination. You know, basically everyone's keeping each other honest by watching what each other is doing. I'm not suggesting for a second that there are any regulators deliberately doing things, but once you start having a country's premier saying we've got a lot of endemic corruption here, you have to start worrying. And the fight against white-collar crime is a reference to insider dealing and so on and so forth, we've already discussed. Yeah. And the need for a high level of transparency. Transparency meaning information is made public, that information isn't hidden. That's what we mean by transparency in this area. The whole theory of markets is built on information flows and so on. There's a load more of it over the page, but we can go a bit more quickly through some of these. Although actually the first one on top of page 71 is a little bit scary. Again, these are all still needs. Notice this imperative language of need. The European Union needs this stuff. The need to encourage innovation in financial markets if they are to be dynamic and efficient. And we might worry about that one in the wake of the crisis. Because it was financial innovation, of course, that brought the whole thing down. Or to quote George W. Bush, brought the whole sucker down. Yeah? Fantastic. George Bush, he thought he was kind of off mic talking to a bunch of economists in the White House and saying this sucker could go down. And there's a great headline in The Onion, the satirical newspaper, saying Bush calls for panic. And fantastic, in the middle of a crisis. This sucker could go down. Don't say that in public. Before then, there was a huge amount of video that's all been taken off FT.com, which is a real shame. Lots of, and they were all quite old bankers in the classic English school, you know, pinstripe suits, old boys sitting there going, now you really mustn't overtax the City of London, and you mustn't get in the way of innovation, because innovation is very important. These chaps on Audrey Dutesco, I don't know what they do, but it's marvellous, absolutely marvellous. And it seemed to be the basic tenor. And all those videos were taken off, unfortunately, because they're hilarious, seen backwards through the lens of, you know, oh my God, oh my God. Let's just explain what went wrong in the crisis and just explain how securities got involved there. We know the problem is the subprime mortgage market in the USA, yes? The problem was in the USA that people were being lent money to buy houses, the American dream, yeah, own your own home, when those people were subprime risk. Yeah? Prime is someone that you think is going to be able to pay their stuff back, and has a history of paying things back. Subprime is people who are below that level. So we were lending money, they were lending money in the US to people who, you know, anyone with half a brain would have thought there's a strong risk these people can't repay these mortgages. Yeah. They don't have those kind of jobs, they don't have those kind of incomes, they don't have that kind of credit history. They are subprime. So why were these American institutions so keen to lend this money to these people? If we think about how a bank puts its balance sheet and its profit and loss together, if a bank lends you £100, the way it records that in its books is that it now has an asset of £100 plus all the yummy interest you're going to pay. Yeah? Now, in fact, in terms of cash flow, the bank has spent £100. So we might think the bank is going to say the bank is £100 poorer. But the way they see it is, no, we've written some new business. We're going to get paid that £100 back. So that's an asset in the future. Yes, we've had £100 go out, but we're going to get the 100 quid back again. And we're going to get paid interest every however often you have to pay your interest, every year, every 6 months, whatever your loan contract says. So that's going down as expected future profit. So just on this traditional banking model, if you're in that kind of business of lending money to people and you want to grow and make yourself look richer as an institution, you want to write more and more loans. Yeah? You want to lend more because that makes it look as though you've got bigger and bigger assets. So when you read in the financial press about banks talking about their loan books, they mean the amount of money they've spent. It's a bit like you going into the January sales, buying something for £100 on the basis it used to cost £150, and saying, I've made 50 quid, you know? We've all done this at some point, you know, I've saved 50 quid, and you have that illusion in your head of, I've actually got real money in my hands now. No, you've got a thing you didn't otherwise want, you think you've got for a good price, and you felt good for half an hour about it. So banks, it's kind of slightly backwards logic. So, these banks are trying to grow. They're at a time when the US economy is just going up and up and up and up and up. Part of the reason for the US economy going up and up and up is that China had too much cash. As China was booming, China was terrified of inflation in China because there was so much money in China. So the Chinese government were investing trillions offshore just to get money out of China to stop domestic inflation. And so they invested huge amounts in America. Huge irony, of course, you go back to the 50s, you know, communism, oh my God, oh my God, you know, suddenly all that fear about red, when I was a kid, people used to talk about red China, and oh, they're going to take over the world and all this stuff. You think, certainly mid-20th century, Mao Zedong and everything else happened, you know, before my time, but that's why it's still in the collective memory. And yet, you know, the Clinton years, particularly the George Bush years, are being floated on the back of all of this inward investment. So there's all this money washing around. So the American economy is booming because there's all this cheap money around. And so let's keep growing, let's keep booming. We lend more and more money out. Who are the people who are going to do the soaking up and the borrowing? The subprime people that don't have mortgages yet. Okay? And there's another reason why we wanted to go out into the subprime thing. It's because we could do something called securitization. And this is the kind of new kid on the securities block. If you're a bank and you have all of these people out here that are going to borrow money, okay. Multicultural world, let's do them all in different countries. someone for a laugh has just put the wrong colour caps on these pens. That person must be a lawyer because they're grey. You've got all these people out here, all these subprimes, okay? What you have, if you sell basically the same mortgage product to them, all of those people, every month, are going to be making you an interest payment, yeah, to the bank. So the bank has got all of these interest payments coming in every month for typical mortgage, 25 years or whatever it may be. Okay? So that's how the banks make their business. That goes down as an asset on the bank's balance sheet. We've got all these mortgages with all these people. The cash inflow from that is the mortgage payment we get every month from them. And then at the end of the life of the mortgage, we will get the capital back. Clever people called actuaries figure out how many people are likely to default. Yeah? What's the rate of default on this? Will 10% default? Will 2% default? How many people will pay back early? Because that messes up your cash flow. The bank always charges you a redemption penalty if you pay off your mortgage early. You'd think at some level they'd be pleased, but no, because it messes up their projections, the way they thought they'd get the money. The banks began to realise this pool of cash flows over 25 years could be sold off. This is an idea that's existed for hundreds of years. It was always known as debt factoring. Someone that went out, you know, and basically so-called factors would buy debts off people in the City of London. Yeah? So-and-so owes you a fiver, okay, I'll pay you £4, and now the debt is owed to me instead. And you think, okay, I don't think I'm ever going to get my fiver back, I've got £4 back, okay, that's great. And then the debt factor would go out, usually large man, hairy forearms, and beat the living Jesus out of whoever it was that owed the fiver until they finally paid up. Yeah? Good old-fashioned debt factors. This is all this is. We are creating all these separate cash flows into one single security. Hence the expression securitisation. So we're taking all of these individual payments, we convert it into one security, and then we sell that in turn off to investors. Now these will often be financial institutions out there in the world. What happened in practice, and we'll talk about this in more detail when we do derivatives later on, is that we would actually create what's known as a special purpose vehicle, SPV. And often, if you look at the chapter in the book on securitisation, there would often be a trustee there as well. And we would transfer from the bank all of these assets into this SPV. Because what this did for the bank, if you recall, was it said, instead of this being on our balance sheet and us having all this risk of all these people not repaying us, let's shift it into a brand new company, a special purpose vehicle that we've created to do this. We'll have a trustee, just like in an ordinary bond issue, that holds all of the shares in this SPV on trust. And then we will sell bonds from this special purpose vehicle out to the investors. And what the investors are buying, effectively, is the right to receive all of these payments from all of these individual subprime borrowers out there in the universe. And so all these investors are buying bonds in a special purpose vehicle, a standalone company. As you know from company law, that SPV then is a separate company. You won't be able to sue the bank to get your money back. You have to proceed instead against the SPV, because that's a separate legal person. So then we have all kinds of things deal by deal about what kind of guarantees will the bank have to provide. We start creating so-called credit default swaps, which I'll explain in a second, that come off that as well, to provide insurance. In effect, we use another derivative, credit default swap, which says if these bonds don't pay out to the investors, whoever provides this credit default swap is effectively insuring those payments. One of the biggest providers of this credit default swap insurance was Lehman Brothers. And that's what really tugged them down. Because when all these things went wrong, suddenly Lehman Brothers had effectively insured all of them. Lehman Brothers, AIG, all of these firms that had a real nightmare in this market, were notable. Citibank was selling a huge amount of this stuff. Legendarily, Chuck Prince, that fabulously named Chuck Prince. He looks exactly what you'd expect him to look like if you Google him, I would suggest. I worked at Citibank. A huge organisation, so huge that if you wanted to do business where you had to bring two different bits of a bank together, it was easier to go outside Citibank than to do it internally, because the internal politics was so vicious. Who's going to get the profit? Who's going to pay for the photocopying? It's unbelievable. I think, well, I'll go do this with Morgan Grenfell. What's the point doing it with you? Vicious. And apparently they have one of the worst IT systems going. It seems to be one of the problems. They merged Citibank with Travellers, and they just couldn't get their systems to work, and they've been living in bedlam ever since. It's crazy. Chuck Prince said, when all this was obviously going wrong in the world, Citigroup, as they're now called, was still dancing in this market. As long as the music's playing, we're still dancing. What? It's not a prom. It's a securities market. Absolutely hilarious. Anyway, more of Chuck Prince later on, because I think it's one of the guiding metaphors of all this kind of stuff. The music's playing, we're still dancing. You're a banker, what's the matter with you? So that's what securitisation was all about. So innovation is exactly this kind of stuff. Somebody realised we can make money off lending even to people who might be able to repay. Because what we do is we take all those mortgages or credit card receipts or any cash inflow like that. We package it together in one single security and we sell that off to investors. by parking it in an SPV and by issuing bonds from that SPV. So in effect, the bank drops out of the picture, if you want to borrow from property law last year. Because you've transferred all of this to another company, it's not your problem anymore. These clever banks were getting this stuff off their balance sheets. And that's why you then wanted to go and issue more of these mortgages to subprime. Because this is making you money. There are loads of investors for these things. This is new, oh my God, this is so profitable. So you suddenly think, well, that last one made a bomb, let's make some more. So you go and find more, even subprimier people, and lend them money as well. So this is just this big circle of lend more, lend more, lend more, to make more and more of this stuff. Okay. I'll unpack one of CBS's in a second, but... No, Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae in the US are government or organised entities that effectively deal all with all these mortgage products to ordinary human beings. So they're ultimately in a very complicated way in the US, almost a state guarantee for a lot of these domestic mortgages. It's a very complicated system. Because in America, you couldn't possibly have a state-run organisation that guarantee everyone's domestic mortgages. But that's effectively what Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae do. But you have to structure it in a way so it doesn't work. So a lot of this stuff was washing through them as well. We'll talk about all of them as the US stuff is incredibly complicated later on. This CDS, let me just explain the CDS thing quickly. This will help make sense if you start to read into the crisis. The credit default swap, which we'll do in detail when we do derivatives later on. But let's suppose we have what's known in the jargon as a reference entity, which we have called, in all our discussions, an issuer. I can't write the word issuer. A reference entity, the issuer of the bonds. Okay. And the reference entity has to pay out all of its coupon, all of its interest, to the investors, the bondholders. The investors, therefore, have a risk. What if we don't get paid? Using financial innovation, using derivatives, it was thought, well, why don't we just have, what colour is that one? Green. Why don't we just have a bank? Okay. In fact, let's call them a swaps dealer. This is how it's often discussed in the jargon. A bank out there in the world that says, we, the bank, will pay to you, the investors, an amount equal to the coupon on the day you're supposed to receive the coupon. Okay. So I'll just call that the coupon equivalent. Okay. So if you're supposed to receive, I don't know, $100,000 on the 1st of May, the swaps dealer is saying, we will pay you $100,000 on the 1st of May. In return, the investors are required to pay to the bank what they actually received from the reference entity. So, assuming the reference entity, the issuer, has actually paid its interest on the bonds as it's supposed to have done, these two green amounts should cancel out. The amount the bank is supposed to be paying, the coupon you're supposed to receive, should be the same as the investor's actual receipts, minus a small fee. Okay, so every payment date, the swaps dealers would take a fee for putting this deal together. As long as markets are performing, the swap dealers is therefore just making fee income. Yeah? And the rest of it cancels out. If the reference entity fails to make a payment, however, then the bank has to pay the coupon equivalent, the amount of money that the investors should have received. But the investors, if they don't actually receive anything, are paying back zero the other way. So in effect, they've acquired insurance against what they're supposed to be owed. They've got insurance against the reference entity, or referee entity, actually making its payment or not. We can't call it insurance, because unless you're an insurance company with authorisation to sell insurance, it's a criminal offence to do something which is actually providing insurance. So one of the great debates in derivatives markets is how can we explain this as not being insurance, but never mind. That problem seems to have gone away in practice. Talk about it later. So this is done originally by investors that actually have exposures to these bonds. Clever people then realised, well, why does it just have to be listed to people that have actually got an exposure? We can use this to speculate. We can speculate on the reference entity's credit worth. Effectively, we can bet What do we think the chances are that the reference entity won't make its bond payments?
As though it was a horse.
And so instead of it being investors who are taking out these credit default swaps, we suddenly have a whole range of other people, and let's just call them gamblers.
We mustn't use the word gambling, because unless you've got a gaming license under the Gaming Act 2005, that would be a criminal offence too, but never mind, it's Christmas. Gamblers.
People who don't have bonds are simply saying, let's pretend virtual casino, yeah? Let's pretend that we've got bonds, and let's just, you will pay me, you know, I pay you a fee up front, and then I'm basically, that's my bet. If the reference entity doesn't make its payment, then you have to pay me the coupon equivalent I would have got if I had actually been an investor. And this market becomes massive. Suddenly this ability to bet on people's credit worth. It's a whole new thing to gamble on. Traders have gambled on which fly is going to land on which desk first, which drop of condensation will run down the window before the other one. They've run out of things to gamble on, and this is a whole new arena. Again, Lehman Brothers is massive in selling these CDS, not to actual investors, but to other people out there in the world. And AIG got into this as well. They realised they could do a lot of this kind of business too, because it's really profitable as long as these reference entities are actually making their payments. As soon as they start to wobble and people aren't making their payments, and particularly we're talking about bonds and these kind of securitization structures, as soon as these ordinary subprime people aren't making their mortgage payments, so the SPVs aren't getting enough income to pay out to their investors, suddenly Lehman Brothers and everybody else is having to pay out a huge amount on these credit default swaps. And that's where all the pressure comes from. And the huge problem is, what's the value of these deals? Lehman, it seems, was giving a much, much higher value on its books to the income it thought it was going to make from these kind of transactions than anybody else in the market, which is part of the reason why that crash was so big. Because Lehman was borrowing, for every dollar it had, it was borrowing 44, so that was a real problem to start with. Much, much higher than anybody else, their borrowings. But also everyone thought Lehman was worth a lot more, because it was valuing its business much, much higher. So when this crash came and it realised all this stuff isn't actually worth very much at all, suddenly the whole thing crashes from being what everyone thought, Dick Fuld, everyone else thought was enormous, to being zero. It's a scary one. And it's the innovation. It's all this clever new credit default swap being put in here, and also these securitizations. The one other thing that happened late on in this market, or later on in this market, was these things became what known as CDOs, collateralized debt obligations, which meant that instead of just selling one bond, you would have different types of security bound up in these things. Because, you know, subprime at the bottom, these people are bad credit risks. To keep our interest rate payments quite low on our bonds, as we know, we've got to have a good high credit rating. So what happened was we jumbled up a lot of stuff together in these securities. Some good stuff with the rubbish. And like a beef burger, you put some salt or a sausage, you put some garlic in it, you put some stuff in it so it tastes of something, and then you put sawdust in too. You claim you've got a tasty sausage at the end. The maths in this is basically saying the good stuff will outweigh the bad stuff in a rising market, therefore you should rank this at AAA. And a lot of the rating agencies did that. One of the issues we're going to talk about with Tort next term is going to be whether or not the rating agencies themselves were involved in negligence or even, say it quietly, fraud in doing this. You know, was that reckless to such an extent that it should be treated as being fraud on the old Derry and Peak test? And so that's where we're going to go with that later on. But all this innovation, this is what created the crisis. So there's an irony there on page 71 when we start talking about the need to encourage innovation. You know, query now, is this what happens when you have too much innovation? So that really is the conceptual roots of the crisis. It's a couple of things that came together. These people not making their repayments, and these CDS products amplifying the aftershock. If it was just these people not making their repayments, that was bad, and that would have been an American problem, their domestic market not working. As soon as everyone started to play on this international CDS market, then the whole thing just amplified out, and suddenly we all got infected. Jolly good, and on that cheery note, I think that we can do that, leave that for today. Merry Christmas, all those things. See you in January, and we'll pick that up.